Back with you on Friday, April 16th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. We wrapped up the week first speaking with State Senator Republican Heather Summers from the eastern part of the state on some pending legislation in the General Assembly. And in the 5 o'clock hour, a return visit from Professor Sarah Crawford, a professor and doctor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University, on the latest news surrounding the coronavirus and the vaccines. State Senator Heather Summers is with us. Heather, hi, you there?
Yes, I am. How are you today?
Excellent. You know, Heather, we put somebody on the moon 52 years ago. You think we could get this right? You think we could get it right?
Well, that's Eastern Connecticut for you.
Well, Heather, that was my first thought. And interestingly enough, you say that. You know what I did last weekend? I drove the length of Route 169 out in your part of the state.
You did?
I did. Because
a scenic road.
Oh my God, it's great. It's great.
It
so
beautiful.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking of that last week and thinking of you now when my cell service kept dropping out, but you're right. It is a beautiful road and I hadn't driven it in years. Very cool. Heather, the reason I wanted to have you on, and let's reset this for the folks who weren't around, we're getting these conflicting numbers now about if this bill goes through to get rid of the vaccine exemption for folks who cite religious grounds. The accepted number, Heather, at one time was 8,300. Now I see there's a note generated by the Office of Fiscal Analysis. No, it's only 1,500. You said you thought it could be 30,000. Where do we stand on this?
Yes, well, it's a little bit confusing, but there are individuals in the state of Connecticut that have taken a religious exemption for usually one or two vaccines. They have a very deep religious belief on a certain ingredient in the vaccine or for whatever their religious belief is. So when you take a religious exemption, it stays with you, and the DPH does not track what vaccines you have and what vaccines you don't have. Therefore, anyone who takes a religious exemption is considered completely unvaccinated. There are 8,300 religious exemptions listed on the DPH website. Mm-hmm. There are 8,042 listed on the Department of Education.
Okay.
This bill going through, one of the caveats is if you don't have all of your vaccines, you will be, quote, ineligible for an education in Connecticut, meaning the state will be paying for vaccines to help these religious exemption folks get vaccinated. And there's a cost associated with that, except the Office of Fiscal Analysis wanted to just include 1,575 people when we have over 8,000 taking a religious exemption.
Now, why did they do that?
There really wasn't an answer. The answer was, well, this is what we got from DPH. And the DPH is the Department of Public Health, by the way.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The question was asked, was DPH just accounting for 1 year's worth of children? You know, they really have to apply this to all of the children taking a religious exemption. And the second part of this bill, which is the most interesting part, quite frankly, is Connecticut has the fifth highest vaccination rate in the country. The religious exemptions that we have are at the national average. They are not above the national average. They are not below the national average. 45 other states in our nation allows for a religious exemption. It is a very small number of children. And again, many of these children are taking it for one vaccine. The one in particular, which seems to be the culprit, is a flu shot when you're 4 years old. Many parents do not want a flu shot when they're 4 years old.
I'd never heard
that. They take an exemption on that.
So that's the one, Heather, that's the real sticking point. I'm glad you mentioned it because I never heard that.
It appears to be. You know, this is just from the data that we can collect or we can gather because DPH is not forthcoming or does not have that data.
Yeah.
Except that child, if they're missing one vaccine, is considered completely unvaccinated, which is also an issue. So if you look at the list of schools in Connecticut, I think there's 554 schools.
Yeah.
There are 120 schools that are falling below what DPH would like to see as the vaccination rate to keep us protected, particularly on the measles, mumps, and rubella shot. Overall, we're at 96.2% compliance, which is the fifth highest in the nation. But there are a few schools that are falling below.
Okay, Heather, hang on just a second. Okay. If you could, I'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Can you hang on for me a minute?
I can hang on.
Sure, hang on. Heather Summers, Republican State Senate member, shedding a little light on this whole vaccine thing. Back with her after traffic and weather together and a few other things right here on WICC. And there are undoubtedly some Fairfield County parents who choose, for religious reasons or whatever, not to vaccinate their kids. They could be affected by this bill still being kicked in around, bandied around in the General Assembly that would remove the religious exemption that is currently enjoyed by about 8,000 kids, we think, in Connecticut, according to state officials. State Senator Republican Heather Summers with us for a couple more minutes. So, Heather, I know this is tough, but if you had to put odds on this as to whether this actually gets a floor vote, what do you think at this point?
This bill is going to go to the House on Monday with a fiscal note that is inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
It is not complete. And it's not accounting for one of the biggest side effects of this bill. If you look at the schools that are falling below where DPH would like to have us be for vaccination rates, there are many schools, especially in our cities, Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, where the school is falling below the vaccination rate and there is no religious exemptions and there is no medical exemptions. These are just children that are either not complying or they don't have the correct paperwork, or they have just not submitted what they need to. All of those children, according to this bill, will be ineligible for an education in the state of Connecticut. They will be kicked out of school with no recourse to attend public school. That's why this bill is so bad. In addition to the fact that we have rights here in the state of Connecticut and in our country, within the law right now, there is a provision, as there is in 45 other states, that if you have a religious exemption against a particular vaccine, you have the right to use that exemption to not get that vaccine. If there is an outbreak of the disease, you sign an affidavit that you will pull your child from school and quarantine them until the outbreak passes. That has served us since the 30s without an issue. Yet now we have big government going in and mandating, we don't care about your religious right. Either your child gets all these vaccines. And when I was young, there was probably 6 vaccines. And now there is 24 vaccines and 72 doses that are required. If you don't do that, we will not educate your child in the state of Connecticut. And we have a constitutional requirement and right that every child gets an education in the state of Connecticut. So there's a lot of conflicting issues within this bill. The fiscal note did not account for those students that are not complying. And there's close to 30,000 of them in the state of Connecticut.
All right.
And a lot of them are in our areas where we have folks that are on free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. English is a second language. And those are primarily around our cities. So this has very, very negative effects on the future of some of our children. And you're also stripping away a religious right. And within the bill, it states that if you're in seventh grade and above, you can keep your religious exemption. So I guess if you're seventh grade and above, you probably can not comply.
Wow.
But seventh grade and below, you can't.
See,
so
Heather,
now you're creating
this is
two
just
classifications of people.
It's just Heather, just another example of something I always point out here on the show, and this is why I try to get deeply into these bills, because there are so many things the general public doesn't know. Heather, thank you for the time. We appreciate it. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Republican State Senator
you
Heather
too.
Summers. Thanks, Heather. Bye-bye. Appreciate the time. We carry the governor's twice weekly news updates. We try to keep you updated on everything happening, and we check in with our roster of experts here, and welcoming back among them Dr. Sarah Crawford, Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, Paul here again. How are you?
I'm very good, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm good. I trust you are well and healthy. And so let me ask you, initially, Dr. Crawford, and I've talked to a lot of friends and family in the pharmaceutical business over the past couple of days. Anything you see significant as far as statistical means is concerned with, you know, some of these questions now regarding the J&J vaccine that has caused on the federal level a timeout here? What do you think of all that?
Well, I've been following it very closely, as you can well imagine. There is some reason for concern scientifically, clinically, in the sense that a significant number of people have developed this very rare form of blood clot in the brain. Probably the only reason it was ever detected as a consequence of the vaccine is that under normal conditions, it would occur so very rarely that seeing any kind of a spike drew attention to it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the basis of the concern. The idea clinically is first do no harm. But it's a very complex question because in the absence of the vaccine, if a person contracts COVID, they're 8 to 10 times more likely to develop a blood clot than if they were to take the vaccine. So it's been a very low number of people, but researchers still don't know exactly what's causing this. It's happened with both the AstraZeneca and the J&J vaccine. So there might be something to do with the viral vector or the DNA source of the vaccine. So it's a very interesting question, and it's one with full disclosure. People need to be aware that there is a very, very small but perhaps significant risk for that type of vaccine.
What about the messaging here, Dr. Crawford? We're seeing and hearing, well, there have been, you know, 7 million J&J doses. We're talking about 6 or 7 people, so it's a 1 in a million shot. Is that, how can I phrase this? Is that being statistically and research-wise honest, or is that just an effort maybe to keep people from going crazy here?
No, I think that's very honest, that the data show that there's been about 6 cases in the United States for 6.8 million doses. So it's very low. It's around the level of 1 to 1 million. So one person out of 1 million recipients might develop something like this, which is very, very low. I think we're at the forefront of a new age in America where the general public is becoming so much more aware of medicine and science. And I think that's very important. And I think full disclosure is very important as well. But I think we're going to have to learn as a general public that no intervention is ever completely safe. You know, getting the polio vaccine until very recently when they used to use the Sabin vaccine, the live attenuate in the U.S., there would be occasional cases of polio mm-hmm. due to the vaccine itself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we want to see things, you know, the medical community giving us a total, you know, carte blanche on moving forward in a very positive way. But there are risks associated with anything. And I think the risk-benefit calculation is very important. But I do think it's really great that people, the public is so much more aware of what's going on. So you can make intelligent decisions and be involved in this type of conversation.
And having said all that, I would think by my untrained eye with the numbers I see, Dr. Crawford, the numbers for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, even into some of their lower age testing levels now, is pretty good.
Well, certainly the vaccine is working well. I mean, if it weren't for this sort of difficulty that's developed in women, particularly between the ages yeah. of 18 and 49, you know, other than that, it's a great vaccine. I mean, you see the same thing with the AstraZeneca. We're not talking about that as much in the United States because mm-hmm. this is a more worldwide scenario, the same kind of problems going on and conversations and decision-making, which is very, very difficult. So I think the biggest risk in all of this is that we might slow down the progress that we've made in people receiving vaccines worldwide, because this is a worldwide problem. As long as the virus is circulating around the world, generating all these variants, and it's posing new risks for all of us. So I do think that that's really the most difficult part to deal with. Yes, you want to have a vaccine that's as completely safe as possible, but this situation, unfortunately, may frighten people off from getting any vaccine
yeah.
and certainly has delayed the
giving of these particular types of vaccines throughout the world. And certainly the AstraZeneca is used throughout, not in the U.S., but certainly very important in other areas of the world where the pandemic is ramping up.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Dr. Crawford. And our guest is Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of genetics and cancer biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Why the non-approval yet in the U.S. of the AstraZeneca vaccine? I mean, we have Pfizer, we have Moderna, we have J&J on a timeout. Why the AZ vaccine not approved yet?
Well, we didn't really do the clinical trials. We didn't want to accept the European clinical trials and just sort of import them in as data. The FDA wanted to have, the United States-led clinical trial.
Mm-hmm.
And so because we're so busy testing all of these vaccines, we haven't really gotten to the point of testing the AZ, the AstraZeneca, to the point that we would be able to give the emergency use approval. So it's sort of logistic, and also the fact that the Moderna and the Pfizer, came to the forefront so quickly, and we just kind of went with that, So I don't think it's anything specifically against the AZ, although now this has been going on for almost a month now, that in Australia and South Africa and in parts of Europe, they're not using the vaccine. They're so concerned about this blood clot situation.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that the vaccine doesn't seem to do so well against certain of the viral variants. So that's another consideration. So I don't think AstraZeneca is going to be in the U.S. anytime soon.
If finally, Professor, if you are in the front offices and the researchers at Pfizer, I would imagine you're pretty happy. You think they are?
Actually, I don't. I really don't.
Because really?
There was a paper that just came out today, believe it or not. It's not peer reviewed. Now science is going so fast that they preprint everything with COVID. And there's a big study that just came out that suggested that the level, and I don't want to say this to alarm anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just reciting what I've read
and
what's out there. But the statistics they analyzed, over 500,000 individuals in various categories who have had the vaccine, haven't had the vaccine, and these rare blood clots.
Yeah.
And they found that there were a couple of cases with the Moderna and Pfizer as well. So whether that's just random, numbers are numbers. Statistics are statistics. Sometimes they can go any way you want. So, actually, AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson wanted the help of Moderna and Pfizer to actually look into the situation, and they didn't want to get involved in that because they want to stay steer clear. We're not involved. But who knows where this is going? We're all in the forefront of medicine these days. Every new development is in the newspaper, and we have to realize that we're all learning together. And if we work together and we're all honest, hopefully we'll come to the best possible way of dealing with this pandemic.
And the journey continues. Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of genetics and cancer biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, good to talk with you again. Stay safe, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Very good. Same to you. Take care.
Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of genetics and cancer biology at Southern. So there you go.